Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Kishore Hari, director of the Bay Area Science Festival and your moderator for today's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Dr. Sebastian Sung. Dr. Sung is professor of computational neuroscience and physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He received his PhD in theoretical physics from Harvard and formerly worked at Bell Labs. He's also an external member of the Max Planck Society, has been a Packard Fellow, a Sloan Fellow, a McKnight Scholar, a PopTech Science Fellow, and he's even an avid squash player on the side. His research on artificial intelligence and neuroscience has been published in leading scientific journals and also featured in the New York Times, Technology Review, and The Economist. His laboratory at MIT is currently inventing technologies for mapping connections between the brain's neurons and investigating the hypothesis that we are all unique because we are wired differently. Please welcome Dr. Sebastian Sung.
Thank you very much, Kishore. And I give my thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. There's a paradox involved in writing a book, which is that I was motivated by the desire to share my passion for the brain with the rest of the world, but the actual practice of writing a book is extremely solitary. You sit alone and you toil away, and it's really hard. And now is the payoff, I guess. I get to share this with all of you, and so I'm really grateful that you've come to listen to this program tonight and ask questions also, of course. Now, how many of you have actually heard the word connectome before this event? One, two. Okay, so a small number of you, and that's because it's a new word. So I congratulate those of you who are in the know, as Kishore said. But those of you who've never heard of the word before don't have to feel embarrassed because it's a very new word. And in fact, all of you are now in the know. You are the hippest intellectuals in San Francisco, because you know about this new idea of the connectome. And so, although we have a book outside on sale and my name is in big letters, this celebration, I would say, this gathering is not about me and it's not about a book. It's about something much bigger than that. It's about an idea whose time has come. And in fact, the idea is old. It was, I think, in the late 19th century that scientists first realized that the brain is a network of neurons, but only until now. What's new now is that we have the technologies that we can finally dream of mapping this extremely complex network and thereby learning very valuable information that will help us understand how the brain works. And so this is not the birth of a new idea that you're witnessing. You could think of it as the coming out party. It's no longer a private obsession of just a few fanatic scientists, but I think it's a dream that we can now share with the world. And these plastic cups should be filled with champagne. You can complain to the authorities here. they are water, but this really is a celebration. All right, so what is a connectome? Well, this book really explains the quest for connectomes, but more broadly than that, it explains what neuroscience is all about. And so a surprising thing is that although there's incredible public fascination about the brain, there's really little understanding of the public, or most of the public, about what most neuroscientists actually do, which is study the brain at the level of neurons. And that's what the first part of this book is about. Neuroscience started out with the idea that we can understand the brain by dividing it into a small set of regions. You all heard about left brain and right brain and maybe frontal lobe, parietal lobe, and so on. So if you divide the brain into regions and go around assigning functions to these regions, you can gain some insight into how the brain works. And even doctors can use this information to interpret the symptoms of brain injuries. This approach has been powerful, but it's not enough, right? Because the next question is, if I know that a region is involved in a certain mental function, how does it perform that function? Why would it fail to perform that function in a mental disorder or a learning disability? And how does that region change when I learn something new, when I improve my brain? Answers to these questions can't be found if you consider a brain region as an elementary, indivisible unit. You have to see how the machine works. You have to take it apart. And that's why it's important to study a brain region as an assembly, more than an assembly, a complex network of maybe 100 million neurons. So I wrote that part of the book to explain why we have to study neurons. And it's really not an easy sell because neurons seem so remote. This world of the small, this unseen world of neurons, may seem very remote from the questions that we care about. And yet I'm arguing that it's critical that we investigate this unseen world. And that's what science has always done. Try to relate. The power of science is to reveal the unseen world and relate that to the world that we care about and that we live in. Now, I should say I'm going through this book at a lightning speed. I'm giving you claims. I'm not really giving you arguments. But you can read the book if you want to have a sustained intellectual experience and feel the argument. And you are people of ideas, so I'm sure that you'll do that. So part two. Well, part two tries to explain in more detail why we care about connections between neurons. Right? I told you we care about neurons, but why should we care so critically about the connections? And I introduce a doctrine, a way of thinking called connectionism, which has been around for really about a century, I would say. And connectionism attempts to explain all these mental phenomena that we're familiar with as the outcome of interactions between many neurons. And I make two points in this part, two major points. One of them is that the connectome, the map of connections between your neurons, is not static, not completely static, but it can change over time. So the neurons in your brain can become wired differently over time. And one way that happens is through experiences. Experiences actually leave a mark on the material structure of your brain by rearranging in some way, which we don't know yet, but we have good reason for believing that it does. It actually rearranges the pattern of connections inside your brain. So the first reason to study connectomes is that experiences leave traces on connectomes, and that's probably that's at least our best hypothesis for how we actually store memories. Now, the second reason to study connectomes is to understand the role of genes. Now, the study of genes and their effect on the mind has been controversial for a long time. It has inspired name-calling. People get mad at each other. They get irrational. They call each other, you know, they can be fist fights because this is a really charged issue. The relative roles of nature and nurture in shaping our minds. How much is really the result of experiences? How much of it is inherited from our genes? Now, these holy wars, I think, within science are over in the sense that all scientists agree both are involved. Genes affect the brain. Experiences affect the brain. We have to move beyond philosophical arguments and dogmatism, and we have to understand exactly how it is that genes affect the brain. How is it that experiences affect the brain? Specifically, real data. So there's many ways by which genes can affect the brain, but there's one particular one that I focus on in the book that genes control the process by which the brain wires up during development in the womb and in early childhood and even in adolescence. So the brain, remember, is developing. The whole body is developing from a single cell. The brain develops. The development of the brain is even more intricate maybe than any other organ. All these neurons have to be created and born. They migrate to their proper positions inside the brain in a complex dance. They send out branches, right? Neurons look like trees, so they extend all these branches that entangle with each other into a dense kind of spaghetti. And then those branches make synapses on each other. Those are the places where neurons communicate with each other. And all of these processes are guided by, orchestrated by, the genes. Genes help create connectomes. So you could say that the connectome is the place where nature meets nurture. That's why it's so important to understand. And indeed, if we want to have a science of personal change, a true science, so you can go to the bookstores, there's shelves upon shelves of self-help books, which these days adopt some kind of neuro-speak, right? But if we want to have a true science of personal change, we will have to understand connectomes. There's no way around it. It's a huge challenge, but it's what we have to do. And remember, pretty much, maybe I shouldn't qualify it with pretty much, every important change in your life is ultimately about changing your brain. Going to school and learning something. Falling in love. Being a more compassionate spouse. I guess no one has that problem here. Healing from a stroke. All of these things involve changing the brain. And the argument from the book is that perhaps the most important aspect of changing your brain is changing your connectome, changing your brain's wiring. All right, so that's the argument for why connectomes are important. How do we go about finding them? Let's say you accept that. Sign me up. I want to find connectomes. How do we go about doing it? Well, let me show you, in fact, the only organism for which a complete connectome has been found, and that is this tiny worm. The nematode C. elegans, a favorite organism of study by biologists. It's only 1 millimeter long. It lives in the soil. It's kind of cute, at least to me. I don't know. And here is its connectome. I don't know about you, but this reminds me of those maps I see in the back of in-flight magazines. I guess I'm spending too much time on planes. Just take one of those maps. I love maps. I can't help looking at those things. Replace a city, every city by a neuron, and replace every route by a connection between two neurons. And so this map has 300 neurons in it and 7,000 connections. Now, you also have a connectome, but imagine that map has 100 billion cities, and there's 10,000 flights from each city coming out of every city to other cities. So there's no way that map for you would fit on this slide or even in a telephone book. It's a huge, huge amount of information. The connectome for the worm, you might ask, Does it vary from individual to individual? It turns out that every worm's map has the same cities, but there are some small variations in the roots. But your connectomes vary much more. There's a huge amount of variability compared to that of a worm, and that's justification for the idea that we are much more unique. Each of us is more unique than a worm is. Maybe that could just be narcissism. But maybe there really is some science behind it, that our connectomes are much more different from each other than those of worms. So the hypothesis is that your memories are stored in your connectome. Maybe your personality, maybe other aspects of your, maybe the Bach sonata that you learned as a kid, learned how to play in those piano lessons that seemed to last forever, right? That those are all encoded here. But we've never been able to test those hypotheses because we haven't had the technologies to see connectomes. And it's kind of sobering because this map that you're looking at here took over a dozen years to find in the 1970s and 80s. So given that incredible amount of labor, what chance do we have against the brains of more complex organisms like mice or monkeys or even humans? Well, our only hope is that technology has gotten a lot better since then. So I'm going to show you some of the technologies that are being developed right now that make scientists like me optimistic. There's fantastic new automated imaging technologies that give us very high resolution images of neurons. And remember here, so you've probably seen pictures of neurons, but you've seen pictures of a single neuron on a background of other invisible neurons. But the imaging technologies I'll show you here show all the neurons at the same time. And then there are technologies for analyzing these images. So what I'll show you first is a video. It's made by my postdoc, Daniel Berger, using data that was acquired in the laboratory of Jeff Lichtman, my collaborator at Harvard University. You'll see many, many very thin slices of a mouse brain arrayed on a silicon platter, and we're going to zoom in by a factor of 100,000 times. So as you see, as we zoom in, you'll see white dots right around now. Those are the cell bodies, the round parts of neurons with the nucleus and DNA. And we're going now to the space between those cell bodies. And we're now at the level where we can see branches of neurons and, indeed, even the synapses, although if you don't have a practice eye, you may not be able to recognize them yet. So suppose we want to see the branches of neurons. The first thing we need more than a two-dimensional image. We need a three-dimensional image. That's found by taking images of many of those slices, many of those thin slices, and stacking them up to form a three-dimensional image. And still, you may not see anything that looks like those neurons you've seen in the newspapers and so on. So what we're doing now is coloring in the cross-sections of an individual neuron. That neuron has been cut into many thin slices, and we're just coloring in the interior of this branch of a neuron. And we do that over and over again, slice after slice. And that reveals a little stretch of a long branch of a neuron in red. And the green is another branch of another neuron. And they're touching each other at two points. And at these two points, there are synapses. Let's look closely. Let's look inside the green neuron. Inside the green neuron, you should be able to see little round, these little circles. Those little round things are little bags of molecules called neurotransmitters. And you've all heard that word before, right? Neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin. They sound like abstractions. But this is what it looks like inside. That's where the neurotransmitters are. They're packaged up. And when this neuron up here, the one that was green before, if it wants to send a message to the other neuron, when the green neuron wants to send a message to the red neuron, it releases the contents of one of those packets into the narrow cleft between the two neurons. And the other neuron on the other side senses that neurotransmitter molecule and receives the message. So that sounds like a dry textbook account. So let me tell you what that means. Every time you think the most refined thoughts, your neurons are spitting on each other. Or a more romantic image would be they're releasing perfume. Right? And the other neurons smell that perfume. And maybe that's when you're thinking about your loved ones. But that is how the communication is taking place inside your brain. All right, now how do we find a connectome? Well, we treat that whole stack of images as a three-dimensional coloring book. And imagine coloring in all those branches of neurons, different colors. And one by one, we find the synapses inside this volume. And at every synapse, we note the colors of the two neurons involved. And if we tabulate that information, we could find a connectome. The catch is that this is very time-consuming. My postdoc, Daniel Berger, colored in every piece of every branch inside this cube, and it's packed. And it took him 250 hours of labor. But this is really not very much, because that's what that cube looks like against an entire neuron. Right? Little pieces of branches. And that's what that neuron looks like in comparison to a mouse brain. And that's what that mouse brain looks like in comparison to your brain. So it's very complex inside your brain. And that's my excuse. That's why we haven't figured it out yet. We're not slacking off. We're not And I like to think we're not dumb. It's really complex in there. And in fact, if we scale up even to just 1 cubic millimeter of brain, it would take Daniel somewhere between 100,000 and a million years to color in every branch of every neuron if he never took coffee breaks and never went to sleep.
And he
what? That's right. That's right. All right. So what do we do? So, and this amount of data is now starting to be produced. It, with new microscopes from various companies, it will become possible to image a cubic millimeter of brain every 2 weeks, generating 1 petabyte of data, the equivalent of 1 billion images from your digital photo album. Who is going to look at all that data and figure out what it means and find the connectomes, et cetera, et cetera? Well, we need better technologies for analyzing that data. We need artificial intelligence. And my lab has worked for several years on making computers that see well enough to color in, do the job that Daniel does. But as you all know, in real life, robots don't see as well as they do in the movies. So they still make mistakes. We still need people to interact with the AI to correct the mistakes of the AI. And so I'll show you now a website that we're developing called iWire.org. I like E-Y-E. This website allows anyone to become an explorer of the brain. In this case, we're not studying the brain proper, but we're studying a piece of neural tissue, the retina, that's at the back of the eye. And so we have images from our collaborator in Germany, Winfried Denk, which showed the structure of the complex structure of the retina, all those tangled up branches of neurons in these images, and we need to trace out the branches of neurons, find the synapses, and map the retinal connectome. AI is not enough for it, but if we want people to interact with the AI, and we want to do that on a massive scale. We want to recruit people like you. We want to recruit high school kids, anyone who wants to learn about science, but also discover new science at the same time, can come and join this effort. So there's various tabs. Oh, you can see, here's the invitation, right? Welcome to iWire, where you can help make discoveries about the neural structure of the retina. It's a call to arms. And there's various tabs here, neurons, where you can learn about what neurons are, what's known about the retina. And critically, we have another tab, which is the play tab. And we can play a little game. Remember when you were a kid, you had a coloring book? Well, here we have a 3D coloring book, and we can move back and forth in the slices, a little cube of the retina about the same size as you just saw before. We can move around inside that. And you see on the left-hand side, the cube is shown, and there's a yellow plane, and that yellow plane moves up and down, showing me the height at which I'm at in each two-dimensional cross-section. And in blue, you see here what the AI has colored in. The smart computer has already colored in part of a branch of a neuron for us. And your job in this game is to find out if the AI stopped where it shouldn't have stopped. Did it make any mistakes? Well, here's a little spot. It's not a big mistake, but right here, we can click here, and we can tell the AI, fill in those areas. Oh, the AI made a big mistake here. It stopped coloring. And now we tell it to start again, and it continues. And as we color in, that extension that we just added is showing up over here in the three-dimensional view. If we make a mistake, this is just an instructional tutorial. If we color the wrong space, we get a little feedback that that's wrong. I propose putting in a really obnoxious noise, but my students overruled me. So you can learn. And then once you've done the training tasks, you can now contribute. You can do real tasks. So here you're being compared against an expert to grade you, but once you've graduated, you can go and help color in the wires of the retina in pieces of the retina that haven't yet been seen by any expert. And so you can help us map the retina. And this is just the beginning, right? So right, this is the basic science project. How is the retina wired up? But there's so many interesting questions that we can address together if we unite. One of the biggest ones is to search for connectopathies in the brain. Some brain disorders are degenerative, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. We know that neurons die. They are starting to fall apart. But other brain disorders, like autism and schizophrenia, the neurons look healthy. What's different about those brains? One big hypothesis is that they're wired differently. The neurons are perfectly healthy, but they're connected up in a pattern that is not normal. So eventually, this technology, and I'm saying pretty soon, we would like to launch a project where we search for connectopathies, where people can actually do autism research and schizophrenia research from the comfort of their own living room. Now, I've talked about the science of personal change and the technologies that we're developing to actually map connectomes. I should now describe the last part of my book, which considers the most radical dreams about change, those espoused by the transhumanists, those people who want to change humanity beyond what nature has given us. They have two main dreams. One of them is cryonics. That's the practice of freezing yourself after you die in the hope that some advanced civilization of the future will resurrect you. And the other is more extreme. It says, let's forget about our bodies. Let's transfer our minds to computers. Let's live forever, happily ever after inside a computer as a simulation, a simulated me. And that's called mind uploading. These are science fiction dreams, right? And people argue, well, is it really possible? If you have a beer or two, you can get into a nice argument about whether this will ever be possible. And my point in this book is to introduce a dose of science into science fiction. Can we imagine a way that we could scientifically test these wild claims of cryonics and uploading? And I propose that through the idea of the connectome, we could test. We can't prove that they will work, but we can imagine ways of disproving them. And that's when you know you're actually on the way to science. When you have the possibility of disproving something, of falsifying it, then it's really science. So if it's really true that my memories are stored in my connectome, then the critical issue for cryonics is whether their procedure for preserving the brain preserves the connectome. We know that the brain starts to fall apart when you die, very rapidly. If the connectome has been erased because the wires disintegrated or the synapses are not staying together, then our advanced civilization of the future might resurrect the body, but there's no way it would recover the memories. And the same goes for uploading. The only chance that the uploaders have for this to work in the next century would be a connectome-based simulation of the mind. We'd have to take your brain, slice it up really thinly, extract the connectome, and then simulate your network of neurons. That's the only remotely plausible method that people discuss. And so it's critical to address the question, is the connectome enough? Maybe the connectome is necessary, but is it sufficient to simulate you? And so that's why the science of connectomics has some bearing on whether uploading could ever work in the foreseeable future. All right, so I've talked about a lot of ideas. I would also like to read a little bit from the book because, of course, reading is not just about ideas. It's also about having fun and having a little pleasure. So I'll read the beginning of a chapter called Seeing is Believing, which describes what you've just seen, the advanced technologies for imaging the brain, showing the brain at this resolution. Smelling whets the appetite, and listening saves relationships, but seeing is believing. More than any other sense, we trust our eyes to tell us what is real. Is this just a biological accident, the result of the particular way in which our sense organs and brains happen to evolve? If our dogs could share their thoughts by more than a bark or a wag of the tail, would they tell us that smelling is believing? As a bat dines on an insect captured in the darkness of night by following the echoes of ultrasonic chirps, does it pause to think that hearing is believing? Or perhaps our preference for vision is more fundamental than biology, based instead on the laws of physics. The straight lines of light rays bent in an orderly fashion by a lens preserve spatial relationships between the parts of an object. And images contain so much information that, until the development of computers, they could not easily be manipulated to create forgeries. Whatever the reason, seeing has always been central to our beliefs. In the lives of many Christian saints, visions of God, apocalyptic or serene, often triggered the conversion of pagans into believers. Unlike religion, science is supposed to employ a method based on the formulation and empirical testing of hypotheses. But science, too, can be propelled by visual revelations, the sudden and simple sight of something amazing. Sometimes science is just seeing. So that gives you a flavor, and I think I've done enough talking. Why don't we take questions?
Let's give a big hand for Dr. Trump. Before I dive into the audience questions, I'm going to relay something that one of my neuroscience colleagues said to me about connectomics. He said, it's incredibly fascinating, and you would be crazy to work on it. And he laughed because...
Is this an opinion or a diagnosis?
Well, what he said was the level of complexity is so immense that the likelihood that that this will be resolved during his lifetime is very low. And I'd love to hear just personally what it's like, whether you agree with that statement, and what it's like to work on a project that is so far future facing.
Well, I have two comments. So one is that we don't have to find an entire human connectome to make progress. Even if we found partial connectomes of small pieces of brain, that is going to tell us interesting things. So every step of the way, although we want to find entire human connectome at the end, every step of the way will tell us something new. But the second comment I would make is that it's not finding connectomes that's a bit crazy. It's neuroscience in general. You know, studying the brain has been, I think, a kind of quixotic endeavor. It's so complex. And there are psychological difficulties involved. It can be depressing. Some of my colleagues don't seem to care. They say, well, I don't care. I'm a humble scientist. If I just, in my lifetime, just put us one more step forward, even if the journey is a million miles, I'll feel like I've done my part. So I think there's part of that. Of course, if you were the only person working on it, maybe it's too much, but you're hoping that your whole community will get somewhere. So everything in subsets, if you think about it carefully, is depressing. And yet it's life, right? Life, if you really think carefully about life, it's depressing.
If that isn't a Valentine's Day message, I don't know what is.
But we remain optimistic. We remain optimistic, right? We do our part. We do what we can. And so your friend is making an accurate judgment, but really it's much more general than that. It's not about connectomes.
I'm going to back up to something I've heard you say many, many times, and that's, I am my connectome. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that statement.
So the slogan of this book is more than I am my connectome. So on the back of the book it says, you are more than your genes, you are your connectome. It's a simple way of stating the idea that my memories are encoded in the map of connections, my personality, that what makes me is in this pattern. That's you are your connectome. But you are more than your genes is that the information in your genome is not enough to specify you. It specifies your eye color, your hair color. It may even say something about which diseases you'll get. But there's so many things that about your brain that have been acquired in your lifetime, and your genome doesn't change across your lifetime. So you are more than your genes. You are your connectome.
And when you bring in this notion of dynamicism to the connectome, is there a way to qualify how dynamic that is?
We would like to have more data on that. We know that the connectome changes. The book describes the four R's: reweighting, reconnection, rewiring, regeneration. Reweighting means changes in the strengths of existing connections. Reconnection means creation of new synapses or elimination of old ones. Rewiring means the extension and retraction of branches. And regeneration refers to the creation and elimination of entire neurons. We know that all of these four processes take place in the brain. We don't know exactly how they contribute to learning or healing. We would like to understand that, and we would also like to have the means for controlling these processes, enhancing them by artificial means. Because these are natural mechanisms by which we can change our brains, but science, it is hoped, will give us new methods for doing so. So that's the change aspect. Now, how much? I don't know. We would say what we know now is that connectomes change more slowly than activity. There's really three levels at which we study the brain: genes, connections, and activity, which means the signals that the neurons give to each other. And those signals are changing at a rapid kind of pace, right? You know, right? You're thinking about how you have to buy bread at the grocery store, and all of a sudden something else intrudes in your mind and you've forgotten it, right? So those things just, your neural activity is flickering like the fire. It's constantly changing. And your genes are fixed since you were born. Your connectome changes somehow somewhere in between. It's more stable than the activity, but it's more changeable than the genes. And in fact, most of our frustration with ourselves is that the connectome doesn't change fast enough or the way that we want it to change, right?
Can we at least say Einstein's connectome is a little more dynamic than the Jersey Shore's connectome?
Einstein lived in New Jersey.
Back to the bigger picture of actually
Bridget Tuttle, right? But anyway,
back to this whole idea of creating this incredibly rich connectome image, even though that's not the end goal, to create a single human connectome. But with this dynamicism that the connectome goes through, by garnering a snapshot, because right, that's what it is, what kind of information are we actually gleaning if it's always changing?
What we would like to have, you're right, so the methods I showed you are about a snapshot of the connectome at a particular point in time. That's fine. What we want to understand is how yourself, your properties at a current time, are encoded in the connectome at the same time. If we can't understand that, we can't really understand the change aspect either. So the encoding at a single time, and you are a person at a particular point in time, and next year you're a similar person, but you're not exactly the same, and your connectome has changed too. So they're changing at similar rates. So I think snapshots could be still very, very helpful.
It's almost like you're saying it'll give us the field, the football field, as it were, by creating the snapshots, and then we can actually play the game.
Well, it's more than the football field. It's really the playbook, right? It's an encoding. We're talking about patterns of connection.
Even in the stock market?
It's the stock market. So there are patterns that investors see in the stock market, a lot of those patterns that investors act upon are more rapidly changing. Here today, gone tomorrow. So I would think that's a rate of change that's a little bit too high, maybe. But okay, fundamental investors who invest in the fundamentals that doesn't fluctuate from day to day. That's more like the connectome.
So I don't want to trivialize the how part, because I think part of what we have here is twofold, is laying out this whole new field, this new language for describing what is happening on a neuronal level.
Yes.
And then functionally, how the heck are we going to do this?
Right.
Which is what your lab is inventing new techniques for.
That's right.
And then once we have that, is the actual application, seeing what we can do with the connectome. So I actually want to go into the how in a little bit more detail. So, you showed a lot of glimpses of how you're using citizen science and other advanced techniques. It seems like you have to invent a whole new field of computation to sort of address this in a way, that there isn't something existing on the market that...
Well, I wouldn't say it's entirely new. Mm-hmm. The field of computer vision, of making artificial intelligence that sees, and the field of crowdsourcing, or I guess the field of social computing, people call it. How do we use the internet to make us smarter instead of dumber, right? How do we use these new methods of social organization to create something, to do something constructive? I think that's a challenge faced by computer science in general. So it is true there's something that's special about what we're doing, but on the other hand, it is within a whole zeitgeist of activity in computer science.
Are you able to bring in those lessons from the field of basically expanding this whole internet framework of seeing how these networks interconnect and apply it to something like this?
Well, certainly we are piggybacking on their technology, right? That if the internet didn't exist, if it wasn't fast enough, we couldn't even dream of delivering this experience on the internet. So the whole question of how, some people are skeptical that we can succeed in this technological quest, and the degree of skepticism really depends on how optimistic you are about computational technologies, because the challenge here is really about analyzing the data. We have so much data, we're going to generate data at a faster pace. Can our ability to make sense of that data with computers keep up with it and even maybe surpass it? That's a challenge that's faced, again, not just by scientists. Certainly it's faced by scientists on a huge scale, but these days big data is a big buzzword in the business world. So we're faced with that challenge throughout society.
So let's take a leap. We're going to take a leap that you walk down the street to Zynga, and they set up iWire on Facebook, and we solve this problem in a few years. Because everyone, instead of farming, now goes to mapping neurons.
No, it really depends on how fun can we make this experience. Mm-hmm. And there's no fundamental limit on how fun we can make it. That's just our creativity. How creative can we be in making people want to do this?
So now we've mapped either a piece of the connectome or something bigger, even a whole one.
Right.
And you talked early on about how our memories aren't necessarily enshrined in our neurons, but in the wiring. And so now I have a connectome. Can you actually pull out a memory? Could you recreate my first kiss with my wife?
You don't play it over every day in your mind? So
yes, I do. I'm going on the record. Yes, yes. She's listening somewhere. Yes.
Well, in the book, actually, one of the experiments I propose is to... So a lot of the experiments we propose are in animals. And so one proposal is to read out the memory of a bird's song from its brain, from its connectome. Right? It's kind of the analog of a pianist playing the Bach sonata. Is there some pattern of connections in that pianist's brain that enables the pianist to generate that sequence of notes every time? We can investigate that in a bird.
And leaping off that further, some of the audience questions that are coming emerging out of this is that if we take that far enough, can we actually sum this up to be around consciousness? Could we actually take all of those memories that you're writing and actually...
I would say that's a separate question. So there are really two notions of self here, and they're tied up, again, with this dichotomy of activity and connections. So the conscious self is the one that is constantly changing. In fact, we could fall asleep. You could get bored and fall asleep immediately, right? Your conscious self could change rapidly, and that's because activity changes rapidly. But there's another notion of self, which is the stable self. Every day you go to sleep, you wake up in the morning, you're the same person, basically. Your consciousness went through all kinds of crazy changes, but you're the same person with the same annoying habits that you wish you could get rid of, right? So you're the same. So there's been a lot of talk in the public about the conscious self, and this book is about another self that is equally as important.
As a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Sebastian Sung, professor of computational neuroscience at MIT and author of Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are. And I'm going to even a more bold question from the audience is, can you speak to how the integration, how our understanding of connectomes will play a role in our understanding of gender differences? Do we expect to see a difference?
Do I really want to touch that question? I think it's a long way off. I think it's a long way off. And the reason is that I do fundamentally believe that connectomes are the way to have a science of differences. Differential neuroscience really means relating our uniqueness to the uniqueness of our connectome. But by necessity, a lot of these experiments are going to be done in simple systems, in animals, like you saw the worm, right? And so much of gender differences in humans can't possibly be addressed by experiments on animals.
What about
I think.
Going
because
beyond?
It just the effects of socialization, everything, our social structure is so complex that I don't know that we can. Those are the last issues that will really be, I think, addressed by connectomes.
What about aging? Because we can see how the connectome's evolving. Will that infer something about how we're changing as we
Yes, age? Aging, we will learn something about that, right? We don't have any real understanding of why it is that the aging brain seems to be less plastic. And some people even question that. You know, can
you explain what you mean by plastic?
So as you get older, it is conventional wisdom that it's more difficult to learn something. Something new, right? That learning a second language as you get older becomes more and more difficult. Now, first of all, there's a lot of controversy about can we demonstrate this conventional wisdom by rigorous experiments, rigorous empirical observation just at the behavioral level? And then the second question is, if it's true, what is it about the brain that's different when you're older? And indeed, I believe that the studies of the connectome are critical to address this question of plasticity. The four R's I talked about. So the four R's I talked about were ordered in how dramatic the changes are. So the first one, reweighting, was just a change in the strength of a connection. And remember, the last two were about actual whole branches or entire neurons. So those are the most dramatic changes to the connectome. And one way of thinking about it that people have proposed is that the dramatic changes become impossible as you get older, even though the minor changes are still happening. So imagine a forest, right? Imagine that you went and you planted a forest, just starting completely from seeds. The first year you come back, all kinds of dramatic changes are happening. Trees are growing up out of here like that. But 100 years later, you come back year after year, the forest looks almost the same. A few changes are taking place. So that's one theory, but it's theory. We don't have the answers from the data. That's remains to be studied.
I think I can understand why some of your colleagues say neuroscience is depressing. So the forest isn't changing. I think that there are a number of questions asking basically where are we going to be in 10 years. And I think that's reflected back in the notion that 10 years ago, all we heard about was the power of genomics. That was new on the scene. We saw Craig Venter on the Today Show announcing that his whole human genome was sequenced. 10 years from now, are we going to be in the same spot where this is the holy grail, or is there going to be something new on the scene?
Well, in 10 years, what I would like to do is be able to see a memory for the first time, to see the effect that an experience has on changing the wiring of a set of neurons, which has been hypothesized but never scene. Because memories, because of their persistence, you know, a memory can last a lifetime. It may well be that there's a change in the material structure of the brain, and we want to be able to see that.
I want you to expand upon that. What do you mean when you say see a memory? Because I think everyone has this sort of like guttural notion of what that would look like.
Well, the theory that has been around since, around, I guess, 1949 is that the neurons that are activated by an experience somehow become wired together more strongly when you store a memory. And so by looking at analyzing images like this, we could potentially see that strengthened connections between those coactive neurons. That would constitute material, you know, really seeing the stuff of memory. So that would be, I think, an incredible, for me, incredible breakthrough. The second thing that I would like to see within 10 years is to see connectopathies, see these miswirings. The press is always saying Johnny's that way because he's wired differently. But that's just it's really just a speculation. Can we see those differences in wiring? Schizophrenia, for example, 100-year history of failure to find a clear and consistent pathology of the brain. Can we see a difference? And if we could find that in the next 10 years, that would be a huge success. It's not a cure, but if you can't see what's wrong, how can you have a true science of curing?
What kind of diseases are you expecting to be sort of lumped into that? I mean, you've mentioned autism, now you've mentioned schizophrenia. Is there a whole host
It's the diseases that are said to be developmental, not degenerative. Degenerative ones, we see, can clearly see something wrong in the brain. But the developmental ones, the brain looks healthy.
And so a part of this would just be a fundamental saying, we can actually say this is what is happening. There's a fundamental difference. Whereas we haven't been able to say that.
Well, we may not even know exactly what's happening. We may not know why the brain got wired up differently. We may not know we're not going to know necessarily how to fix that. But just being able to see something different, I would say that's the difference between groping in the dark and actually being on the right track, right? So imagine the study of infectious diseases before you could see microbes. You can see the symptoms, but if you can't even see the microbes, how do you know you have to get rid of the microbes? That's the kind of status we're at in developmental disorders.
You make it seem like we're just at the infancy of everything.
Oh, yeah. We're at the beginning. It's an exciting time because the technologies of genetics and imaging, all these things are coming online, and computation, they're enabling us to do things and have a real chance at making progress.
So I'm going to take a couple more audience questions before we come to the end. What are the advantages of a bottom-up analysis of connectomes to discover how the brain works over a top-down analysis of the brain structure, especially given the vast volume of data analysis required?
So the question is about bottom-up versus top-down, and I don't know exactly what that means. I could interpret that question many different ways, but one interpretation is that top-down means you're searching with a hypothesis in mind. So you start out thinking, this is what the answer is, this is my big picture, and then you start exploring from the top down, getting down to the nitty-gritty. And the other approach is to say, I don't know. Let's gather a huge amount of data, and let's look in a hypothesis-free, unbiased way at what might be wrong. That's the approach of genomics. So I think that both are important, and in fact, right now, because we're so limited in our ability to find connectomes, we can only look at little pieces of the brain, so somebody has to give us a hypothesis about where to look. So we are, in some sense, pursuing this top-down approach still. But the goal of this kind of data-driven science is to develop our information-gathering technology to such an extent that we can just go in without a hypothesis and find out what's different.
And coming back to this notion of memory and experience, you mentioned sort of memory as being wanting to see a memory as being one of these key pieces. But what constitutes a memory? Or what constitutes an experience? How do we know where the beginning and end of a memory is?
Well, we say that someone has stored a memory if they can somehow recall that experience. So there has to be some mechanism for taking information that's in the activity, neural activity, and storing it in the brain in a form that's not activity. So that's kind of the dividing line.
Do you see that as being a difficult area to explore? Is like, because you're not only looking at the number of connections, you're looking at almost the strength of that connection in a lot of ways. And that varies greatly.
Right. So there's questions about how well we can actually estimate the strength of a connection by looking at it in a microscope. And strength is somewhat related to size. So that's a more technical issue in which a lot of research is needed.
And coming to sort of the towards the end of the book, as you discussed, like because the book really lays out sort of neuroscience 101 in a lot of ways. And then you get to sort of the big ideas that we could create. And you mentioned this a little bit at the top, is the idea of being able, could we freeze our brain? Could we just plastinate our brain and recreate ourselves? And I want to come back to that because it's there's this amazing sort of sense, as I was reading the book that came out, is there's this notion of immortality wrapped up in being able to understand our connectome. And I was wondering if you could address that, if you see it the same way, that there is this hope for being able to, for us to live forever.
My purpose in that book is not to give us hope. My purpose is to be the critic, right? Because science is all about, we have to subject ideas to critical scrutiny. I know that people have these hopes, and I think some of the people don't want any criticism. They want to treat it like religion. They want to believe that they have a way of doing it. But I think the mentally strongest people in that group, in the transhumanists, want the criticism. They welcome it because they want to improve their technology and so on and so forth. So my role here is really the gadfly.
So when you see these groups that are freezing tissue, you're a bit skeptical, let's just say, about being able to revive somebody from a cryogenic state.
Of course, scientists should be skeptical, right? That's the way we make progress. We make progress by criticizing ideas and finding their weaknesses.
So on the flip side of that, what would it take to preserve somebody's connectome after they die?
So how much time do we have, actually? Could I do one more reading to wrap up?
We have a few minutes.
We have a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, we could do one or two more questions then. Why don't we do one or two more questions?
The reason I ask that sort of death question is there is a there are actually a number of questions about what happens to your connectome when you die.
Yes.
And this whole notion of is it something that immediately goes away, or is it something that can live on? I think it's sort of touching on this question of almost this soul question.
So that's another buzzword in the kind of phrase in the book where I say information is the new soul. You could quote me on that. I say it half in jest, but half seriously. So there are philosophical doctrines. So you may be familiar with materialism, the idea that the universe is a bunch of billiard balls bouncing around, obeying the laws of physics. And there's the doctrine of mechanism. La Mettrie, the French philosopher, was the first, I think, he wrote this book, The Man, the Machine, that we're a bunch of cells. Parts of the machine are cells. They're interacting with each other. Or the neurons that make up our brain. It's a complicated machine. But the transhumanists actually turn that on its head. They say, you are not your atoms. You are the pattern in which they are arranged. You are not your neurons, but you are the pattern of connections by which they are organized. And information in that pattern is, in some sense, a ghostly thing. There is a material instantiation, but the information itself can be transferred into some other form. Like I can take the information in my laptop. Let's say that you were really mean and you chopped up my laptop and I wanted to resurrect it. I could take that hard disk out and I could move that information to another laptop. Right? So we've come, and that's the reason why people are some people are fascinated by transhumanism now, because of our familiarity with computer technology, backups of computers, we become familiar with the idea that information might be the soul. And what information would that be, the connectome? So that's the philosophical kind of idea that permeates the ending of the book. And if you think about it, all of our efforts to be immortal involve preserving information. If you have kids, you're passing on the information in your DNA, but also you're nurturing them. You're telling them to do things, so you're impressing information on their brains. There are people who write novels and songs to be famous. They're propagating their information, right? So all these effects, all these bids to be immortal are about preserving information about you. And so cryonics is in some sense the ultimate, preserving all of the information that's in my brain in deep frozen at liquid nitrogen temperatures. Can I preserve that?
In a way, do you see yourself as a historian of sorts?
Sure. I talk about the history of ideas, and you could argue that that's the only kind of history that really matters, right?
I think we can hear one more reading.
So I'll read from the introduction. No road, no trail can penetrate this forest. The long and delicate branches of its trees lie everywhere, choking space with their exuberant growth. No sunbeam can fly a path tortuous enough to navigate the narrow spaces between these entangled branches. All the trees of this dark forest grew from 100 billion seeds planted together. And all in one day, every tree is destined to die. This forest is majestic, but also comic, and even tragic. It is all of these things. Indeed, sometimes I think it is everything. Every novel and every symphony, every cruel murder and every act of mercy, every love affair and every quarrel, every joke and every sorrow. All these things come from the forest. You may be surprised to hear that it fits in a container less than 1 foot in diameter, and that there are 7 billion on this earth. You happen to be the caretaker of one, the forest that lives inside your skull. The trees of which I speak are those special cells called neurons. The mission of neuroscience is to explore their enchanted branches, to tame the jungle of the mind. Thank you all for coming.
I think we're gonna wrap with one last question, and that's the question I sort of left at the end, because you talk about this a little bit in the book. So, emotion. You sort of read this incredibly stirring piece of your introduction that summed up the curiosity and wonder that drove the book, and probably also covered all a range of emotions. So, how does that fit in here?
Yes, so emotion, we know that there are certain regions of the brain that are really important for emotional experience, that there are certain neurotransmitters called neuromodulators that are broadcast across the brain during emotionally heightened states. So I talked about the perfume of the brain being the neurotransmitters. At most synapses, neurotransmitters are causing a very specific kind of communication between two neurons, like a private communication. But there's other kinds of neurotransmitters that are more like broadcast. That's what we think of with perfume, right? You can't, no matter how much you love your man, you can't broadcast your perfume. You can't send your perfume only to one person, right? It diffuses throughout the entire room. So there's certain neuromodulators that appear to be broadcast during these heightened emotional states, and there's evidence that they actually have effects on plasticity, on connectome change, that they can really help store experiences in those changes in the connectome. And that's an important question that we need to investigate.
Our thanks to Sebastian Song, author of Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Kishore Hari, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.